Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on January 6, 2018. This is the introductory talk for our 2018 12-week Dhamma study based on my book, The Truth of Happiness. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. So today's the introductory talk for our 12-week Dhamma study. What I'm going to say, most of you have heard over and over again, but one of the things that is a key to developing an understanding of the Buddha's teachings is repetition, coming back to the same things. The Buddha spent 45 years teaching his Dhamma, and everything he taught was in the context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths, to develop understanding of Four Noble Truths. By necessity, the Buddha taught a very specific and very direct Dhamma. And in reading a lot of the Pali Canon, I haven't read the whole thing, I don't know if I ever will, what is readily apparent is the consistency in which the Buddha taught in relation to the context, and that he never wasted a word. He didn't feel the need to embellish his teachings in any way. Even something as simple, well, it's not as simple, but as direct as five clinging aggregates. The Buddha used the term five clinging aggregates to describe the ongoing personal experience of suffering. Those five aggregates are form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing consciousness. That's ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The idea of being five noble... the right word I'm trying to use. The idea of being five clinging aggregates, because it's foreign to the way we think about ourselves, is difficult to understand. But when it's looked at in the proper context, it's obvious that, yes, we're made up of these five separate aggregates. Even the words, the five aggregates, relate to other important teachings, such as dependent origination and the Four Noble Truths. When you can start to develop that broad understanding of what the Buddha taught, but also the refined understanding that he didn't teach something else, is as important. And again, just emphasizing, keeping things in context is so important if we're going to develop what an awakened human being taught. So the Buddha, during his 45-year teaching career, had every opportunity day by day to embellish his original teachings, to add something to it, to add a ritual or a certain type of chant or a certain ideology, even a certain belief system. And over the course of 45 years, he never taught anything else except Four Noble Truths or what would support that understanding. So let me just read a little bit from the article. Anybody has any questions, please just holler out and ask. And just in relation to that, from the article, from the beginning of the book, actually. The Buddha did not intend his teachings to be useful only for those with the right lineage, the right karma, the right teacher, the right empowerment, the right social position, or even the right culture. The reason why that's in the introduction is many, many people, it's happened here but also online, are confused by the almost infinite number of teachings called Buddhist teachings that have nothing or very little to do with what the Buddha actually taught. And that in itself leads to a lot of confusion. It leads to a lot of protectionist eye-making. Once we've associated ourselves with a group, whether it's a particular lineage or a particular way of worshiping, again, the Buddha didn't teach worship. Once we identify with these things, or even a general very loose adaptation of what the Buddha taught, meaning anything that sounds kind of somewhat spiritual or pleasant, let's just call that Buddhist teachings. Even wholesome activities can be a huge distraction from what the Buddha actually taught, especially when we start creating identities through things like I just mentioned there, through lineage, through ideology, through rites and rituals. All of these things the Buddha said, don't do. They're just a distraction. Develop the Eightfold Path, and you'll gain the ability, the more integrated the Eightfold Path becomes as a part of our life, the more we gain the ability to say, yes, this leads to the goal, and that doesn't lead to the goal. There's many, many suttas where the Buddha is asked direct questions and he just sits quietly. And the reason why he's sitting quietly is not to be rude and not to act like a know-it-all, even though he did, is to emphasize the point that the question itself can only lead to more ignorance. The question itself doesn't deserve an answer. It's only a self-referential ego personality, that which is rooted in wrong views, that insists on an answer to every question it might think of, and insists on a way of establishing itself in every ideology that's out there, or aversion arises. We've heard about the three defilements of greed, aversion, and resulting ongoing deluded thinking leading to dukkha. The three common problems of human existence. And aversion is just the other side of greed. It's just another aspect of greed, isn't it? And that they directly lead to suffering, to disappointing experiences. And so you can go right back to what the Buddha first stated as the first noble truth, dukkha occurs. And then everything that he taught explains how it occurs. The second noble truth is craving originates and clinging perpetuates dukkha. So again, as we develop the Eightfold Path in the proper context, we're doing it for a reason, to recognize our own craving and clinging. There's not some other more altruistic teaching. Everything the Buddha taught is very, very practical. So the notion that, yes, we should all be loving people, we should all be compassionate, we should all be honest all the time, we should always be contributing to the common good, all those are great ideals. They were just as great an ideology 2,600 years ago as they are today. Why didn't the Buddha just teach, well, we should all just be compassionate, we should all just get along, we should all be loving? Why didn't he just go out and say that? Because it's true, isn't it? We should all be compassionate, loving, and honest, etc., right? We should all be out there working for the common good. How come an awakened human being didn't just teach that? Why didn't he get out on the street corner every day and just talk about how wonderful we should all be to each other? Because an untrained mind can't do that. He recognized the common human problem of a mind rooted in ignorance will create very intricate strategies, including what seems like wholesome behavior, to ignore its own ignorance. And so the Buddha didn't say, why don't we all just get along? It's a nice idea. It'd be nice if we could just say that once and the whole planet would change, wouldn't it? Why don't we all just get along? And we've been trying to do it since we've been on this planet, haven't we? Figuring out a way to get along. We've created very intricate legislatures to try and legislate peace and happiness. And yet we fail to do it. Why? Because we've never created a way to recognize and abandon our own ignorance. That's what set the Buddha apart from every other teacher during his time and every other Buddhist teacher today, or most everyone. He recognized that we needed an eightfold path to understand and abandon our own ignorance. That's the sole purpose that he taught. And so let me just read something that relates to that. This is from the Tsimshapa Sutta, where the Buddha is emphasizing what he taught and the importance of it. And what have I taught? I taught the nature of dukkha, or stress. I teach the origination of dukkha, craving and clinging. I teach that cessation of dukkha is possible.
John, excuse me one second.
Please.
Can we have a little bit of heat?
Yes.
Thank you.
You can have a lot of heat.
Thank you.
Let me go back to this. And what have I taught? I teach the nature of dukkha. I teach the origination of dukkha, meaning craving and clinging. And I teach that cessation of dukkha, is possible. So again, the Buddha isn't saying that it's possible to just be good human beings, to just be moral human beings. He understands, like Morris said, there's an underlying cause or an underlying condition to the greed and aversion and competitiveness and aggressiveness of human beings. And it's rooted in ignorance. And he taught that the Eightfold Path is the path, the Buddha's words, leading to the cessation of dukkha. This is what I have taught. And that paragraph in the Tsimshapa Sutta points us to how we develop awakening as an awakened human being taught it. We're free, of course, we're all free to do anything we want to do. But if we want to develop what the Buddha taught, it'd be best to listen to his words. The Eightfold Path is a path that develops it. It's the more that I practice, and the more that I teach, the more surprising it is that I spent at least 15, maybe 20 years as a wholehearted Buddhist student, and hardly ever heard the words Four Noble Truths or Eightfold Path. I took vows in one of the largest Tibetan lineages. And I never once said, maybe you should study the Four Noble Truths a little bit. Maybe you should learn, wasn't even taught, maybe you should learn how to meditate. And again, I'm not putting down that lineage, just using it as an example of how far and how powerful the strategies we've developed to ignore our own ignorance, when even within modern Buddhism, there's such a strong platform taken to continue to ignore that. We don't even hear about Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path. And I'm not going to go around the room and talk about that, but I bet you every one of you has had that experience if you've looked into Buddhist teachings, that you very rarely heard about that. So the Buddha awakened to the profound understanding that it is ignorance of Four Noble Truths, that all matter of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering arises. And he taught a way of developing understanding of that so that we as individuals can bring that process rooted in ignorance to cessation. It's up to us. It's not up to the right teacher or the right lineage or the right chant or the right belief in a certain deity to bring us from confusion, delusion, and ongoing suffering. It's up to us. And when I finally realized that, and to this day, it's the greatest freedom I've ever come across, because up until that time, I kept trying to find a way to fix this broken self, because I was told from basically the day I was born that there's something wrong with me. Those of you that were brought up Roman Catholic, you understand original sin, which really got me going. But also just a reinforcement of Western society that in order to make yourself better, you first find out what's wrong, pick that apart a little bit, and then build on that. It never works. But the Buddha said there's nothing wrong with any of us except our views are rooted in ignorance. Let go of the views. And so everything he taught was geared towards developing a framework so that we could recognize wrong views rooted in ignorance. That's the entire purpose of the Eightfold Path. It's not to save the world. It's not to make us feel better. It's to make us gain wisdom where there was once ignorance. Is that clear? So the important thing is not to monitor how we're feeling with our Dhamma practice, although it's a good idea to recognize as we're progressing that our minds are more calm and peaceful. What's really most important is to recognize that my mind is more concentrated and I'm starting to recognize my own contributions to my own confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering, the Salatha Sutta. What am I doing that's keeping me locked in a less than satisfying life experience? Why do I find things unsatisfactory, disappointing, maybe even to the point where I am quite mentally distressed? Where is it coming from? Why am I unhappy in this moment? Why does it feel like something's missing in this moment? Because I want this moment to be different than it is. There's nothing wrong with this moment. There's nothing wrong with me. There's nothing wrong with the world being as it is. If my mind is less than calm and peaceful, it's because I've substituted, intentionally, but maybe ignorantly, I've substituted something that can't give me satisfaction in this moment for what's occurring in this moment. And that can only occur from a distracted mind. A well-concentrated mind will never substitute anything for reality. It can't. It's not possible. Why? Because that, and I'm talking about an awakened human being, because that awakened human being has gained full human maturity. What's the definition of maturity? You understand what's occurring in your life. And if you understand your life as your life unfolds, why would you want it to be any different? Because it can't be. And that brings us right back to the potential that each moment has in the understanding of becoming and the whole point of this introduction. So that in this moment, we are well concentrated enough. Again, it doesn't mean, I'm not talking about awakened concentration. We are well concentrated enough to continue to incline our minds towards awakening, towards gaining a life of lasting peace and happiness, a mind of lasting calm and peace. As you heard, that's the only thing the Buddha concerned himself with, and he was incredibly successful. Remember just a few weeks ago, he went through the Anapanasati Sutta. one of the reasons why I taught it then, leading into this workshop, was to introduce the slightly enhanced meditation instructions, but also to point out again. Remember how that sutta started? The Buddha's holding out around 20 senior monks that have awakened, listening to his teachings. He's holding them out as an example of how to awaken and how awakened people act during meditation. Many, many thousands of people awaken listening to the Buddha teach. Excuse me. Which is exactly what the Buddha taught, that these are teachings that are to be developed in this lifetime and can be fully developed in this lifetime. He said repeatedly, if this was not possible, I wouldn't teach it, meaning awakening, developing full human maturity in this lifetime. And then he basically said, here's an eightfold path. If you develop it wholeheartedly and develop a few other things that support that understanding, and I'm talking about things like the five clinging aggregates or even the five hindrances, the four foundations of mindfulness, the Anapanasati Sutta, to understand what arises and passes away during meditation, and what it means to develop the framework of the Eightfold Path. So you can look at the framework of the Eightfold Path as a framework for restraint. And as Dhamma practitioners, we can use it to keep our Dhamma practice well-focused and refined on what the Buddha taught, or we can choose to add all kinds of other things and embellish that and more than likely create distraction where there's this perfect jewel of understanding. That's why we talk about the taking true refuge in the Buddha, his Dhamma, and a well-focused Sangha is doing it without the need to embellish it or alter it in any way, isn't it? Because they've stood the test of time. There's no reason to change it. So there was one other thing that I wanted to read, if I can find it.
John, I can't recall this. I can't hold things in mind that long and listen. But you said something, and I won't be able to call back, but it was very, very clear in the beginning of that whole exposition there. I read, like, because I didn't really quite hear the word. It was something to the effect of, substituting, you know, every time we... You know, you substitute something that basically something that's impermanent and fleeting, and then, you know, that will give that you think will give you satisfaction,
mm-hmm.
Takes you off the path. But do you remember how you said it? Because
I don't
usually remember exactly how you said things.
I don't.
Oh, I can listen to it.
You can listen to it.
Substitute something for.
A
conditioned or mind, mood, and ignorance will always substitute something for reality because it doesn't want to live in reality.
But
I'll have to listen to it.
I can't
remember my own. Does anybody remember what it was?
Yes.
Substitute something for.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everything you said on Tuesday night was brilliant. Or maybe last Saturday.
So that is the. Thanks for bringing that up, Moore. That is the problem with ignorance is that the overall strategy to continue to ignore our own ignorance is just that it's substitution, substituting things for how they are, for how we'd like them to be, and that really occurs mostly between our ears. That even what's occurring, because our thoughts are rooted in ignorance, will change things as they occur to fit our view. That's the nation of conditioned thinking or confirmation bias. Even people that we talk to, I think you probably would recognize this, people that we might have formed a certain opinion about and they're not fitting that opinion, and I'm couching those words carefully because it could be someone who's not so pleasant but we want to see them more pleasant or vice versa. And in the interaction, if we're mindful of what we're doing, we can catch ourselves changing our view of what they're saying to fit their view of who we think they are. And we do that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that plays out on an individual level, and because of the way things have developed recently, it's playing out on a worldwide level too, isn't it? And so the only way, when we recognize that's what's occurring, the only way we can overcome that problem is to be well concentrated in this moment, to see it. And that's where the framework of the Eightfold Path comes. That's where something as simple as the explanation of what wrong speech is, gossip, idle chatter, etc., etc., is so important. Because in the moment, if we're gossiping about someone, it's because we're trying to elevate ourselves, eye-making, above someone else. And we're using a conversation with someone else, another person, to justify that and give it authenticity. Right? Does everybody see that?
Yeah.
And so that, it's just such a practical and useful example of how to develop the Dhamma. The Buddha taught that 2,600 years ago. Be mindful of gossip. Be mindful of idle chatter. Be mindful of hurtful chatter. Why did he teach it then? Because it was just as relevant then as it is now. And as we develop and able to hold in mind the framework of the Eightfold Path, we can recognize when we're doing it. So I just want to say a few more words from the Buddha, and then we'll conclude this. The Buddha continues from that. This is what I have taught. Excuse me. And why have I taught these things? Because they are connected with a goal. They relate to the rudiments of a mindful life. And remember, the Buddha didn't teach some generalized mindfulness, although that's a good idea. He taught very specifically how we should be mindful. He first taught it in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, and then he taught it again in the Anapanasati Sutta to remind us to deepen concentration so that we can hold in mind the Eightfold Path and the factors that develop awakening. These teachings develop disenchantment and dispassion. These teachings develop cessation of stress and unhappiness. These teachings bring calm and direct knowledge. Direct knowledge. It's an important line there. Direct. It's not some generalized esoteric knowledge. Direct knowledge to the nature of suffering. Remember how the Buddha started this. I teach suffering. I teach the arising of suffering and the cessation of suffering. These teachings develop self-awakening and unbinding. This is why I have taught them. Therefore, your practice is contemplating and understanding, the Buddha now gets into the Four Noble Truths, contemplating and understanding, this is stress, this is the origination of stress, this is the cessation of stress, and this practice is the path developing the cessation of stress. Those are the Buddha's direct words. When you read them and listen to them, how could you get involved in anything else except what the Buddha taught, if your focus is on what the Buddha taught? And why is it that so many people awakened during the Buddha's time, but so few people awaken now? Some of the later developed schools say that it's impossible to awaken now. It will take endless lifetime. It goes against what the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught to take to the Dhamma like your hair is on fire, and in this lifetime, you can awaken. So that's really the choice. I'm not going to read anymore. The emphasis that I wanted to point, it's the emphasis that I talk about all the time here, is on awakening. If it truly is our skillful desire, chanda, to awaken, we have the path right in front of us. It's up to each and every one of us how well focused we'll be and how well we'll utilize and develop the Eightfold Path. That really is the question. Are we going to begin or continue to deepen the ability to recognize distraction as distraction and keep our minds well focused within the framework of the Eightfold Path? And so over the next 12 weeks, what I would ask you to do, and I actually say this to everyone who starts the course, whether it's online or not, to keep your other so-called spiritual endeavors, put them aside for the duration of the course, it's only 12 weeks, if you're doing other things, and just put your focus on meditation and deepening your integration of the Eightfold Path and the other concepts that we're going to go through during the book, like dependent origination and the three marks of existence.
Right after.
This week you'll be reading on Shamatha Vipassana meditation. And so then we'll talk about that next week. But I'd like to hear, we're well developed enough to really have some great insight now into meditation. It's something we've been doing for a while. The week after that, we get into the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. You all have a deeper contextual understanding of that now than you did even a year ago. And you could even think about listening to some of the tapes that we just went through on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. We can deepen our practice in a very auspicious way over the next 12 weeks as a Sangha. And again, these classes are going to be repeated Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday of each week. So the same class. That's today's talk. Any questions about this introduction? Then we'll just go around the room. Yeah. Anthony, good to see you this morning.
Good morning. Great talk, thanks.
Thank you.
Very useful. And reminded me that mostly that you're right, that we don't orient ourselves properly because we're all basically looking for happiness. If I get this thing, this job, this, you know, this salary, this vacation, and really what we're looking for is freedom from ourselves.
Yeah, that's right.
Because if you could say to somebody, well, you could go to Hawaii, but you could be miserable, or if you could have a week of bliss, what would you pick? Probably most people would want a week of bliss.
Yeah.
Than rather than being miserable in Hawaii, so.
I might try Hawaii. Then. just because I've been there.
Hawaii does seem very great.
Yeah, we carry our happiness or our lack of happiness with us, no matter where we go. You know? That the first noble truth that dukkha occurs is simply and broadly a comment on human life. It's got to be disappointing. But if we can change the need for anything to be any different than it is, then we maintain a calm and peaceful mind. And then everything is meaningful, too, by the way. If we're no longer distracting ourselves from what's occurring, things that would normally have been distressful, or even that we might not even notice because we are so distracted, become meaningful. And that's how a meaningful life develops. It's not by getting all the toys in the biggest house on the highest hill. We know that doesn't work. It's by developing a realistic view of how life actually is.
I feel like I felt that, like, sometimes, you know, if something really distressing happens, like if somebody starts to, you know, I experience road rage, somebody was, you know, stuck his finger out at me, and I just, like, let it pass through me. I didn't react to it, and I felt, then I could actually, I felt that I flipped it around, and I felt sorry for how disturbed this person was, and it didn't bother me. But if I bit down into it, I think it would have lasted a lot longer.
Oh, yeah, when you take it personally.
Yes, I think you have to be very mindful of your views, and I don't think that you're not going to experience dissatisfaction in life, but you just know you need to recognize it and manage it better, so that's where this practice comes in so good, to recognize the stress.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's how it works. And a well-concentrated mind is able to have somebody give you the finger and you don't take it personal. It's just an interesting hand gesture, isn't it? Thank you. Jay, good to see you this morning.
It's good to see you. Quick question, did the Buddha have kids?
Yes. Yeah. And Rahula, one of the great sutras.
Able to maintain the composure.
He left home as soon as he was born. I'm out of here. There's a famous sutta, the Rahulavada Sutta, where the Buddha's teaching Rahula when he's 7 years old mindfulness. And it's a beautiful sutta. The Buddha caught Rahula in a lie, but he uses what follows from lying as a beautiful metaphor for teaching young Rahula mindfulness. And Rahula and his mother eventually joined the Sangha.
The other thing I guess I have a question about is, you know, stuff happens, bad stuff happens. You're supposed to get a good, clear look at it and, you know, live with it, whatever. But, you know, as a Buddhist student, that's the way you want to look at it. But as a member of society, you see bad stuff, let's say somebody who's doing badly, doesn't have enough food to eat, you take food to a food bank so that they can get more food or whatever, you know, but there's a little bit of a paradox. Like, you may realize that stuff happens, bad stuff, but bad stuff still happens to you, you know? I mean,
yeah,
right,
that's the first noble truth.
And, you know, you may not jump up and down and freak out. You may deal with it in a way that, you know, with more composure, or in my case, when somebody tells me they have a problem, instead of just saying, oh, geez, I'm sorry to hear that, my first thing is, well, what can we do? You know, well, your heater ran out of gas. Well, we better get the heating guy on the phone and get you some oil out or something. That's the way my mind works, is that, you know, I want to come up with solutions of things. And Lisa is always telling me, I didn't ask you for a solution. I'm just telling you the way something is. It's bothering me. And that's just the way I am. So, you know, I react to bad stuff by trying to correct it.
That's a good.
So if you ignore it and be a good Buddhist, are you being a good human being? Is there a paradox?
Well, I wouldn't say that being a Buddhist means you have to ignore what's occurring. In fact, I think it means just the opposite. But you might have gained the wisdom to know when you should just let something go and just listen, and when there, it's time to act. So understanding the impermanence of all things and that dukkha occurs really develops just the opposite type of mind. You're describing a mind that has misapplied the Buddhist teaching to allow for complete disengagement from the world, rather than being mindfully present and knowing when it's appropriate to act. So there's even I can't think of the name of the sutta, the Ratana Sutta, the Buddha teaches the three refuges. The Ratana Sutta is set at a time when Vesali, a town that the Buddha frequented, was overcome by natural disasters and the following health consequences. People were dying in the street because of the famine and the disease that was rampant. The Buddha heard of this. He went into the town specifically to be of some help, and he didn't look around and see people dying and start doing a dance because nothing bothers me. This is wonderful. The first thing he did is he got the Sangha to address the physical needs of the people in the town. He fed them, he clothed them, he gave them medicine. He took care of their physical needs because it was the wise thing to do. Mm-hmm. And then that night he gathered the town together and gave them a teaching because that was a further wise thing to do. So understanding the nature of suffering doesn't remove us from it. It allows us to act in a directly mindful way, more so than has ever been possible. Again, we've been facing adversity as human beings since the beginning of human beings. And we're no closer to solving the problems than we were at any point in time. We don't deal with adversity very well, even though we like to think of ourselves as advanced. Why? Because we have wrong views. It's exactly what the Buddha awakened to. So it's an important thing that you brought up. How do we act as a Buddhist when we develop understanding? We act with great compassion married to great wisdom because we understand how things. We're likely going to be more meaningfully active in the world than ever before. And we won't be reacting to things that are just common human difficulties, like Anthony just said. You know, the appropriate act when somebody gives us the finger is to feel sorry for them, because look at the anguish they're in, or even worse. And if we can take it to the guy driving down the street who's so stressed out that he can't stand me being in front of him, if we can understand it there and feel real compassion for that poor soul, then we might be able to take it outwards and understand the suffering that other people are in and how it's making them act in a mindless way. But it comes from being the ability to be present with life as life occurs in a meaningful way. So you bring up an important point. Initially, people have said that all the time. Isn't this a very selfish practice? But those are people who just don't understand what the Buddha taught. It's really just the opposite. It's the most selfless philosophy I've ever come across because of that. So thank you, Jack.
You're welcome.
Morna, good to see you. It's been so long since I've seen
Morna.
You.
That's what one of the women I work with calls me all the time. Morna. I really can't recall what I was going to say, but I'm glad to be here. But I was contemplating what Jay was saying, because that's something that I've experienced in my life often. So just the idea of listening, I kind of really got lost on that distraction of sometimes one is speaking and they might be relaying a situation, but they're just kind of, there's sorrow there about it, and that's what needs to be, what I felt sometimes, like that's just what needs to be acknowledged, that the life is challenging or something, it doesn't need to be fixed. But then I also realized that in myself, in repeating things like that, what's the underlying intention? What's my motivation for saying, for repeating a story? Like, what am I really looking for? You know, and so I was going through this whole kind of contemplation of, it's a habitual way sometimes, the conditioned behavior of how to get interaction. So like I tend to, because I've always worked in healthcare, I'm kind of, these stories of loss and grief, you know, are a way, it's like a conditioned way that I interact with people. And So, you know, and really what I'm just saying is, like, I'm feeling this or I'm feeling that, and I don't know, you know, so I, that's just a total tangent there, but it has to, it was in relation to what Jay was saying. So, yeah, I mean, often, so I listen to a lot of people at work, and they're going through situations that cannot be solved. There's no answer for them. It is the first noble truth. And there's a sense of wisdom that, like you had said, and discernment that I try to sit in. Are they letting go? Are they holding on? You know, like, where is a space to kind of just use a discernment to help, and my own self, where am I holding on and where am I letting go of something, and just kind of is what just watching that in a conversation and listening. Is there an opening to let go? Anyway,
thank you. Glad you're here this morning. Yeah, the human beings have a natural tendency to want to help and want to fix things, especially in other people that they care about. And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't try, but there's wisdom to know when it's an aspect of idle talk and idle action to do something that's likely not to have any positive benefit. It just, we just, peace is maintained by not doing anything and knowing when it's appropriate to not do anything. We don't always have to be doing something. The Buddha often referred to himself prior to his awakening as an unawakened bodhisattva. Bodhisattva is a human being who has great compassion for other human beings. But in referring to himself that way, he's saying that I didn't have the knowledge to be of any true value to other people when I was an unawakened bodhisattva. So if we really, and you hear me say this often here, the most loving thing I can do for myself and for all other sentient beings is to take to the Dhamma and awaken, because then I can be of true, useful value to other human beings, much more so than in my ignorant, unawakened self. If I really care about people, I'll develop the Dhamma and awaken. The Buddha taught a path for us to be mindfully engaged with what's going on in the world in a way that brings great wisdom to it. Why? Because we understand suffering. We understand the common human problem of suffering. And we've also developed an understanding of our own contribution. So from understanding my own contributions to my own suffering, I can understand it in others. You know, the Buddha, kind of getting back to what Jay brought up, the Buddha awakened at 35. 36. He taught for the next 45 years. Why? Because he cared about other people. He could have just sat under the Bodhi tree and had people bring him kumquats. He didn't. He was highly motivated because of his awakened state, not because of his bodhisattva state. He was awakened and helped other people because he was awakened. It's what motivated him. It wasn't a false sense of self. He wasn't doing it because he's a good fixer. He's doing it because he's an awakened human being. It's a natural expression of who he is. Lisa, good to see you.
Can I just add two things onto that? One is that often when I'm listening to somebody or myself even, it's really that I'm attached, like there's a version arising to somebody's discomfort. So, and that's what I'm trying to push away. So when I can just kind of like what Anthony said, just be aware, aversion is present, you know, and abandon, you know, also like, so that tendency to want to fix, I think, comes from a lack of comfort in the present moment.
Sure.
So a dissatisfaction with dukkha. What's internally arising.
Yep, that's dukkha. Right?
And so, yes, so just allowing that to be there and passing. And then the second thing is when you talked about the Buddha as an unawakened bodhisattva, having compassion for all beings and their suffering, that's, as you rightly said, that's an unawakened sense of compassion. Compassion from an awakened point of view is to awaken to the truth of the Four Noble Truths, which is understanding of suffering and not suffering.
Yep.
So we don't need to, like, by as you always say, work on the dukkha. That's the distraction. So a bodhisattva sometimes is working on the distraction of dukkha rather than giving somebody something that is helpful to transcend the distraction of dukkha.
Yeah, I would say all the time, but not sometimes.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, well, those of us that are in training, you know, that know our limitations in terms of an awakened mind, you know when to, I'm trying to learn when to, that I have nothing to offer because my mind is not fully awakened yet. So the best thing that I can do is take to the Dharma, not say too much.
Yeah, and that, and it's it really, at that level, it comes down to radical responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, I'm responsible for my own awakening, but I'm also responsible in an exemplary way, meaning by example, of other people who are looking to me. So, and I'm not just talking about because I have this seat, but as a Dhamma practitioner, I owe it to other Dhamma practitioners to do what the Buddha said: stay focused on the Dhamma. Because it's so easy to find other distractions and use them to ignore my own ignorance going forward. Lisa.
Hey,
John. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Well, I'm glad you came last week, so you said, and I think I did see it on the website, too, that you were going to be starting, and that's how we started last year.
Ah, good.
I just think it's been a wonderful thing for us. It's just so weird because if we hadn't discovered this, it would be here. We wouldn't know anything about it. I mean, there's so many things that go on that you don't know. Obviously, that's science. You don't know anything about. There's a zillion things going on you don't know anything about. And then you discover something that you didn't know anything about before. And it's such a wonderful thing. And it just makes you think about things you never thought about before. And in ways you never thought about them before. And every time someone says something, I have a thought about it, and so I have a whole jungle of thoughts about things. So many things seem contradictory to me, and I think the reason is that my regular self would be, you know, my usual self would be, I mean, very unawakened and, you know, clinging aggregates and all kinds of things, but knowing another way, it's, you know, like crept into my head. So there's just, it creates contradictions. And like I meditate. Now, the samatha part of it, I get very tranquil, quiet, and that, you know, just over time, years, it works for me. The vipassana part, the wisdom or gaining insight, I don't know. I haven't gotten to that.
Thank you. It's a very good question. The meditation method is called shamatha vipassana, but the vipassana part should not be looked for in meditation, even though it may occur. We quiet our minds by being mindful of the breath, shamatha, mind quiets, so that that well-concentrated mind, as it develops the framework of the Eightfold Path for experiencing it life, will be able to gain insight into anicca, the impermanence of all things, the anatta, the not-self-characteristic, and the resulting dukkha. Those three things are what we're specifically gaining insight into. It's not a generalized insight. The Buddha was very clear about what to be mindful of and what not to be mindful of. Well, he wasn't so clear on what not to be mindful of, but he put emphasis on being mindful of these things, primarily to be mindful of the arising and passing away of all things, that all things are impermanent. So as your concentration has deepened, I would bet that you've gained at least a beginning insight into the impermanence of your feelings and your thoughts. That's the beginning of profound right view also. So you also said that you're slowly seeing how to apply these teachings. These are my words now. Because you are gaining insight. You're seeing how it works. It does take time, and it does take some effort. And the more effort you put in, the more benefit you'll gain into the three marks of existence. Does my answer help clarify?
And repetition
is
essential.
It's essential.
Key.
Yep.
Because over time, things just have to kind of seep in to the consciousness. I mean, the mind is it's infinite.
Yes, and so then the choice is, what am I going to associate with? The Buddha talks also about association. It's so important what we associate with. So if the mind is capable of, what am I going to associate with? Because that will determine what type of experience and what I learned, what I'm associating myself with. So again, it gets right back to what the introduction. If we want to develop the Buddha's teaching, we need to focus on what the Buddha taught. And it doesn't mean 24/7. But it does, as part of our path to awakening, recognize this is what I need to do. This is, and you mentioned the joyful engagement. The Buddha talks about that as one of the factors of awakening, being happy that you have the Dhamma to practice. You know, the word that's often associated is rapture, but that just means joyful engagement in these teachings, because they will bring peace and calm. And we know that. Everybody knows it almost as certainly as they start practice, don't they? Their mind is more peaceful, even if it's just for a few minutes in meditation. And we build on that. So, thank you. I'm glad you're here today. Jen, good to see you.
Good to see you.
Welcome back.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Well, it's good to be here. I'm enjoying listening to everybody's comments and feeling distracted by all of them. Meaning too distracted to say anything that makes sense, but the thing that I keep hearing as a solution, because I totally related to what Jay said, I'm always looking for a solution in other people's problems, is the middle way, kind of using the middle way to just the idea and the teaching behind the middle way of when I'm feeling or when I'm seeing contradictions in my own mind, kind of knowing that those contradictions are a distraction.
Yeah.
And that there's probably a gray area that I'm not seeing right now because I'm distracted by these contradictions, because I'm distracted by being driven to find a solution. All of that is ego. So if I can just settle into knowing there's a middle way, and maybe I need to put this down for now, then the solution will arise. And that's kind of like the only approach that I have available to me at that point, because usually I recognize, like, at least I'm recognizing that I'm really wanting to find a solution. Okay. So that's my experience with it, because then everything everybody else said was totally, completely relate.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, no decision is a decision too, and it's often a wise decision. The time isn't right. The most important thing I think that we can do for other people is to be present with them. to be able to listen. And that's what that type of mindful presence is what we develop in the Dhamma. You know, and then if it's appropriate to act, we'll know what to do because our mind isn't clouded by eye making. You know, how can I be the hero in this? We just know what to do.
I think you're right, John. I think a lot of times people just want to be listened to.
Yeah.
I was struggling with that a long time with my mother because when my dad died like a year and a couple of months ago, and she still constantly talks about it and constantly grieving, and it makes me upset because I think there's nothing I can do. And I think really the best thing I could do is just listen.
Yeah, it is. You know, getting back to solving the world's problems, if we would learn to listen to each other, you know, that would probably be 99% of it. But we can't, because as soon as somebody else starts talking, there's my point of view. I got to get my view across here. I need you to think my way. The profound understanding of a Buddha and understanding the First Noble Truth that dukkha occurs when we encounter that in a situation, whether it's one-on-one or with a group of people or a situation in the world, we understand that it's just that. It's of the world. Dukkha occurs. Other people are an aspect of dukkha, especially when they're not awakened. It doesn't mean that they should be different than they are either. In fact, the guy with the finger in that moment, he can't be any different than he is. He's doing the best he can. What can I do to help the situation? Well, the first thing I can do is not give him the finger back, isn't it? You know, have the presence of mind to keep my hands in my pockets. That's not doing anything, isn't it? And it brings peace to that moment. So thank you for being a peacemaker, too.
Wasn't
easy.
I had that few seconds of rage.
I grew up with my driving with my head out the window in one hand all the time. Get away from me. Thank you. Don, good to see you again. How have you been?
Great. Great to be back. Busy summer. Really busy and happy to say.
Good.
And I saw this as this 10-week, 12-week course as a great opportunity to jump back in.
Yeah, it is. I'm glad you're here.
Yeah, thank you. And me too. I really liked so much of what I heard this morning. And I've been continuing my work with Truth and Happiness through the year, and I do my daily meditation and daily reading. But being here is different, of course.
It is.
And I miss a lot of this. So this it's really nice to hear your voices. Other voices. Besides my own.
Yeah. It's so important.
Speaking of which, what I got from you, a lot of what you were saying this morning was that I distract myself.
Yeah.
And that is what I do by being so reactionary the way I am at times. And I find that concentration and focus and the mindfulness that I can get from that, from this practice, helps me to be more observant of the world and to live life as life occurs.
Yeah.
To be more present with that, and it's very in that way it's very helpful, because I am a very reactive person. I know that about myself, and that is something that I can just sit back and observe about myself with no judgment, and when I'm able to do that at times, it really is it's comforting. It's what I think what I'm really gaining a lot of from this practice, thinking of impermanence, trying to find a solution, trying to make something permanent in an impermanent universe is something I think I deal with a lot. And it's interesting because a word that came up for me was, fix. In photography, to fix something is to stop the process and fix it in place. Or in my metaphor is to make it permanent. I find myself doing that. I'll grasp at something in a reactionary kind of way because I want to say what is right, what is wrong about this particular thing, In fact, it's just more impermanence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you really understand impermanence, you very quickly stop fixing a broken self, because it can't be. It's always changing. There's nothing to fix.
It's a great metaphor.
Like foam on the ocean.
Yeah.
That's the profound understanding that Khandana got when he first heard the Buddha's first teaching. He declared all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. When I start looking at myself and I'm judging myself harshly, but my next thought is, wait a minute, this is all impermanent, it's based on nothing, what am I worried about? And as the Eightfold Path is developed and further refined, it brings great freedom and great power, because we know that we're acting in the most optimal, awakened way that we can in this moment. Even if there's something, some aspect of our behavior that we look at and recognize it as unskillful, we just change it. We don't have to analyze. We don't have to figure out who's to blame for me acting this way, or what the world's doing that's wrong. Just change the way I think, in a very gentle and peaceful way. In my mind, an awakened mind stays that way. It's not grappling with how to understand things. It understands things. It's an awakened human mind. Thank you. Glad you're here today. Liz, good to see you.
Good to see you. Good to be here. Yeah, I can really relate to the repetition of the whole defiance and defensiveness about situations as they present themselves. I think that's one of the things that I cling to the most, is the idea of, you know, defending this, variety of situations, and sometimes it's easier than others to sort of, you know, forgive myself and move on. You just want to, try to find a way to leave all that behind. And so that's one of my biggest challenges. And then the idea of distractions. One of my favorite quotes from Mary Oliver, the poet, is, and she's speaking in the context of writing, but it's not the outside distractions that get you the most, it's the inside distractions. So for her, she found that it wasn't the phone ringing or something impending chore, it was what she was doing in her own mind to distract her from sitting down and writing and being present in that, in that process, in that moment. And I think about that a lot. So, Happy New Year to everyone. May we all be less defensive in 2018 and more forgiving of ourselves when we are.
That's beautiful. Thank you, Liz. Lorna, good morning.
Good morning. I'm looking forward to the next 10, 12 weeks, whatever, on the Eightfold Path, because recently we've been speaking about the Eightfold Path at the heartwood of the Dharma.
Yeah.
And I think that really brings it home how important the Eightfold Path is to the Buddha teachings. It really is the heartwood of the Dharma. So it's very important. And I'm looking, from that point of view, I'm looking forward to revisiting it, re-looking at it, and rethinking about all that it will present to us. And I think I'm looking forward to that very much.
Me too. Thank you. Gabby, good to see you. Happy New Year.
Good year. It's good to see you. I just wanted to thank everyone who made it last week in the snow, because I did not, but I was able to go on the podcast and have my sangha. Is not courageous enough to drive. So I appreciate everybody who was here.
That's good. And it worked well for you?
Sharing, yeah.
Yeah, good.
And so I wanted to say that first of all. Because I got my sangha, that was really wonderful. And I liked the word joyful engagement, because I was thinking when I picked up the book to start to read it again, that's how I felt, like it was this familiar, helpful, and it just kind of gave me comfort, and I thought, oh, that rang out today, and I said, joyful engagement, and I said, that was so so to have this, you know, again. And I started 2 years ago, actually.
Was it? Wow.
So it's been 2 years, and I still feel like a baby in God. Sometimes have a little bit of insight, and mostly I just connecting to the listening and wanting to be a listener and a sponge and kind of keep learning.
Thank you, Debbie. You have learned a lot, though, in 2 years. There, I know Buddhist practitioners for 30, 40 years that really don't know much about Four Noble Truths or how to meditate or any of it. You know, so you really learned a lot and integrated a lot. Glad you're here. Diane, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good to be here. And I'm fine.
Good.
One of the things that about this bodhisattva fixer, you know, compassionate person is, for me, that I'm learning in spades is put the oxygen mask on me first. What can I do? What can I reasonably do to help another without hurting myself? Which is, has been, I mean, just this, I went out to the clients on Thursday because I knew some people had some stuff that really, really needed to be done. And and I canceled Friday with some people because I was spent. I couldn't do any more. And the thing that I've learned, the wisdom that comes up some is, for me to be honest and you know, do what I can, and then listening is really important. And I'm finding it, as you're saying, more important, in many cases more important. But also to take care, to put the oxygen mask on me first means, you know, that I have to stay within what I'm capable of doing wisely, mm-hmm. lovingly, kindly, to myself as well as others. And to, there's, for me, there's also the faith that if I can't do it, someone else will. And so often these people, many people who will complain or ask for things and stuff like that, really just need to be listened to, because they need to hear themselves say what they need to say, and eventually they say it enough and they figure out, hopefully, in this lifetime, how they can do it for themselves. But me doing for somebody else what they can do for themselves is not healthy, as I'm learning. And meditation gives me the guts to do that. And that doesn't sound very gentle, but it's like some kind of inner strength that comes that says, you know, I have so many times given money, given my time, my energy, and it's really been empty. But with this, with the wisdom of knowing that it's, I mean, I don't know whether I kind of really dig this metta stuff, where metta, I do metta for me first, really teaches me that it's okay to love who I am. And from that, the love for others comes. And through meditation, I see that I can actually love who I am, you know, and I'm using that, that's such an ambiguous word, but to understand my mind, one of the things that I love too about meditation, and I'm here, was coming to the forefront of my mind as comments were made this morning, is I have choices in my mind now. I didn't know I grew up with there was with this permanence. You know, this is the way it is. There's only one way, and it was either Jesus' way or my father's way or somebody, you know, in authority's way. There was one way, and with the spaciousness that comes through meditation in my mind, I see that there are choices. And I think that's the most rapturous thing that I mean, I can even now bump into a day or a thought or a moment where I'm being critical and you know, angry or, you know, some sort of negative thought. And I almost instantaneously it's coming, that's a choice. That's a choice. And I accept that. That's a choice to see it that way. You have other choices. And with that, I'm hallelujah. That's really
cool. Yeah. Thank you, Diane. And it kind of touches on what Liz was saying, too. We truly gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it, when it's appropriate to think this way. And we don't think thoughts that are inappropriate. What does it mean? It means that we've developed the mindfulness of a Buddha. What true mindfulness means. It means mindfulness that is framed. It's a focus type of mindfulness, isn't it? And that's why it's spacious, because it's not cluttered with a lot of other stuff that we don't need to think about or practice. It's just that pure.
If I could just add something, I think to Diane's point that it's important to recognize that you're not that person thinking that thought. If you step back and you can see that you're the person observing those thoughts, and they're not necessarily you, and they're not necessarily true.
Yeah, they're just thoughts of love.
And just let them pass, because in the moment after a negative thought, you're going to have a positive thought, or a happy thought, or a sad thought, and just don't bite down on it and let it pass, and recognize you're the person observing those thoughts.
Yeah.
It's been very helpful to me.
Yeah, it is. Thank you. Our thoughts are as impersonal as anything else. We shouldn't take our thoughts personally. When we really learn that, then we understand the function of thinking. Nearly 100% of the function of thinking is just for preservation of the body. It needs to process information to keep itself going. But most of our thinking doesn't need our attention. But because most of our thoughts are self-referential thoughts, we're enamored with our thoughts. We're enamored with the thought that says, "Oh, I got a little pain in my belly. Uh-oh, what's that?" Rather than just being present with what's occurring, being present with another human being, being present with a sunset or a sunrise or a winter storm or anything else, just being present. It's its own reward. Any other questions about this first class? So you'll read the chapter on Shamatha-Vipassana meditation and practice a little bit, and we'll talk about that. And then the following week we'll get into the four foundations of mindfulness.
Can I just ask one question?
Absolutely.
No question. When you have a desire, you have a desirous thought in your mind, does that always come from your ego?
It's a good question, and I don't mean to be flippant with this answer. It's best to not be too analytical with those things and actually just recognize a disturbance in the mind.
Okay.
You know, that there I want something in this moment to be different than it is, meaning more, less. You know, not to be bored in the moment is an aspect of that. So, but there is a type of skillful desire that keeps us focused on a Dhamma. It's part of right effort.
Yeah.
So again, we get to analyze. Well, and I've had people ask the question: is my desire to awaken desire that's going to hurt me in some way? Why are you even analyzing it? If it's pointing your mind towards the Dhamma, don't worry about it. It's not one way or the other. It's just you're going in a direction. It points to the potential of each moment. It's good to have desire in each moment that passes to awaken.
Yeah. Yeah.
But not so to the point where you can't accept that you're not awakened in this moment. Mm-hmm. It's just more distraction.
Here.
Or you had a question?
No. I saw it and probably just a distraction, but I found it really, really helpful. And one of the sutras, and I can't remember the name, and I'll have to dig it up, because it was a very good description of the early monastic community and how they cared for each other and the the things that they talked about, and if you talk about, so in terms of desires, that which inclines towards dispassion, that which inclines towards, and some other thoughts on right speech that I hadn't ever read before. So it helps with desire, you know, to, like, it's not desire, but it's, whatever inclines towards restraint in conversation even. And so now I've been catching myself to not fan the flames of desire in conversation.
Yeah.
Like around
food. It's important to practice restraint that way.
That's what I mean.
Thank you, Mom. So we'll continue next week. I want to thank, there's five folks joined us today online. Thank you. And we'll finish with the Karaniya Metta Sutta. So find your relaxed meditative... Lisa, do you have a...
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
Jay's brother has a sangha at his house. He practices Buddhism. And he sent me something that I just thought was very nice, and I wonder if it's okay to read it.
Sure.
He says, a few lines from a favorite Plum Village song. Is that Thich Nhat Hanh?
That's Thich Nhat Hanh, yeah.
And when I rise, let me rise like a bird joyfully. And when I fall, let me fall like a leaf gracefully without regret.
Thank you. So find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and be mindful of the arising and the passing away of your breath in your body. These are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, freed from hatred, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.